Thanks for listening to us on the Jefferson Exchange today. We are always glad for your time and attention. And if you'd like to join our conversation on the exchange, you can do that too. Here are the phone numbers, 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. And our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. At some point in your life, it's probably a good idea to sit down and write a priority list. What's important to you? What's on the top of that list of important things? Today's guest taught school for years and had his students write up priority lists. Then doctors diagnosed a brain tumor, and after a while, David Menashe was forced to give up teaching. But he was not finished with his students. He set out on what he calls a vision quest to visit with many of his former students. The idea came from him sitting down to write up a priority list. So David Menashe's book is called The Priority List, A Teacher's Final Quest to Discover Life's Greatest Lessons. And he's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. David Menashe, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Jeffrey, for having me.
So I see you taught English at the same school for 15 years, won Teacher of the Year in your region for 2012. You now live in New Orleans. You point out right off the top of the book that there's no reason I should still be alive. How are you doing?
I can't complain. Any day above ground is a good day when you're diagnosed with brain cancer.
And you worked at what you call Miami's mega magnet school, Coral Reef Senior High School. What makes it a mega magnet?
Well, the school is, first of all, divided into different academies. So the students are focusing their education within that academy, academies such as medical, legal, business, visual and performing arts. So in addition to taking the regular classes that all students take, English, math, science, they were also taking specialized classes that focused on their area of interest.
All right, so pretty comprehensive. Sounds like fairly rigorous work.
But interesting.
Mm-hmm. And it was a magnet for you, too. I mean, tell us, David, how much did you look forward to going to work every day?
You have no clue. I was waking up every morning at 5 a.m., actually looking forward to seeing my kids, to having the opportunity to talk about some piece of work that I really like and share that love with them. It not only motivated me, it gave me a sense of fulfillment and joy that made all of the other stuff, the chemotherapy, the days of endless radiation, worth going through.
And your classroom was something of a magnet for students and staff, too. I mean, tell us about the center of life it seems to have become in that part of the school.
Well, I definitely had an open-door policy where before school, during lunch, after school, that if anybody needed to speak with me, I was there for them. Something I believe my students really respected about me, and it wasn't love or fear that was driving my class. It was respect, and a mutual respect at that.
So how did you approach the students? How did you address them? I mean, you wanted to maintain your authority figure status, but not in a real hard-edged way, it sounds like.
With whatever they referred to me as, I would reflect backwards. So, for instance, if somebody were to call me Mr. Menashe, I would say, thank you, Mr. Riley. It was just mutual respect. They didn't call me by my first name, and I generally didn't call them by theirs.
Got it. Let's talk about the medical troubles. What was the first indication that that something was going wrong?
At first, I was hearing a ringing in my ear, in my left ear. So I went to my doctor, who sent me to a series of specialists of ear, nose, and throat guys who could find nothing wrong. And then that same ringing sound turned into a tingling sensation that spread throughout the left side of my body. At that point, I saw a neurologist who gave me a series of tests, all of which had acronyms for names, EEG, EKG, CAT, MRI. And finally, the MRI found that I had a brain tumor, a rather large one in my right temporal lobe, and that if I didn't have surgery right away, I wouldn't live much longer, just a few months.
Talk about getting that call from the doctor's office about the test results, and particularly, I mean, there was a real indication that, yes, we need to talk to you now.
Oh, yeah. I was speaking with a doctor's assistant who would give me no details whatsoever. She was just saying, no, you have to speak to the doctor. Come after school today. This was in my classroom that this is happening. And I said, really, I can't make it. I'm going to be here until 5 o'clock. And she said, don't worry, the doctor will wait for you. And that just sent a chill down my spine. that not only would she not tell me anything over the phone, but that my doctor was willing to stay that late to give me this news.
And it was a time of year when doctors generally don't want to stick around. Nobody wants to stick around the office very long. When was this? What part of the year was this?
This was actually the day before Thanksgiving in 2006.
Wow. So then you have to get together with family the next day, and your wife Paula was with you when you were at the doctor's office. It certainly makes your news real when you have to tell somebody else. So what was that like, dropping the bomb on your family the next day?
Well, I didn't want to traumatize them. I did not want them to worry about me. So I became very cool, calm, and collected, and just told them, don't worry, I've got this. And I meant it. And ever since then, that has been my mantra. I've got this. This is my reality. This is what is now normal to me. But it wasn't being diagnosed with brain cancer that took me out of the classroom or even the treatments. I went through chemotherapy, radiation, and 3 brain surgeries and barely missed any school at all. In fact, it wasn't until July of 2012 when I had a stroke that left me without the use of the left side of my body and mostly blind, that I realized I can't drive to school, much less be an effective teacher in front of a room of 35 or 40 students, and I had to step aside.
All right. We'll talk more about what happened after that point and what led up to it as well. The Priority List, A Teacher's Final Quest to Discover Life's Greatest Lessons. David Menashe, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. You can join the conversation as well. We'll come back and talk more with David and take phone calls and emails from you if you'd like to join in. Back on the Exchange in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is David Menashe, a former teacher, an English teacher at a high school in Florida. Often had his students make up priority lists. He had to make one up himself after he was diagnosed with a brain tumor that led to surgery and chemotherapy and radiation and a stroke that finally forced him out of teaching nearly 6 years after his diagnosis. He decided to go see some of his students. That's the priority that came off the priority list that he made up. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange, 800-838-3760 or 541-552-6782 or by email jx@jeffnet.org. David, where did that come from, that I got this mentality? Were you trying to protect other people, try to limit the questions? Were you protecting yourself? What was the genesis of that
I think it is almost a
campaign?
Little of all of those. But for the most part, I was trying to be a good role model. I knew that my students would either get sick or know somebody who would get sick at some point or another in their lives. And I wanted them to be able to look back on their time with me and have it relax them. Regardless of the prognosis, they'd be able to say, well, my teacher got brain cancer and he was okay.
Obviously I've gotten with calling you David thus far. At some point in your life, did you actually pronounce your first name a bit differently?
Absolutely. For most of my life, I thought my name was David. My parents called me David. My brothers called me David. And it was only recently that I found out that all along, my name was David and meant to be David. I was actually named after David Cassidy from the Partridge Family. It was just my mother's accent. She was pronouncing it David. So when I went to kindergarten and was asked what my name was, what else was I supposed to say at 5 years old? So I said David, and it stuck. And just recently, I was having a conversation with my brothers and my parents, and I asked, well, how come nobody told me? To which my brother responded, can't you read? So David is apparently my name.
Right.
But I identify with either.
You'll answer with either one. Okay, that's good. And now growing up, you were a guy who loved books. It appeared that you were on your way to a journalism career. So what turned you toward teaching and away from journalism?
Good question. I was going to college studying to be a journalist, but then I simply ran out of money and could not afford the upcoming tuition for the next semester. And this was a semester in which I was supposed to be an intern for Spin Magazine, but I missed it. So when I came back, I was behind in the program, but my favorite professor, Mark Statman, gave me another alternative. He was involved with the Teachers and Writers Collaborative, which is an organization that takes writers or up-and-coming writers such as myself and puts us in a New York public classroom for 1 week with the opportunity of teaching a class along with the teacher. And I was placed in a class of first graders in upstate New York. And this is winter time, and I'm a Miami kid, so it was really a transcendent experience. And on the way there, I was talking to my professor, we were carpooling, and asking him, what do you think it is I should teach? To which he said, whatever it is you love. If you love it, the kids will love it. And at the time, I was really into the poetry of Walt Whitman. So I decided, I'm going to teach a group of six-year-old first graders the poetry of Walt Whitman. And I started off by just reading them some of it, and they were very interested, but I could see they were getting restless. So I told them to all bundle up, put on their coats, that we were going outside. And right away, they liked that. And I gave them each a small stack of Post-it notes and three crayons with the instructions to write down on each Post-it note something that they saw. So we went out to this frozen pond in front of the school, and the kids marched around in the snow, writing down words such as snowflake, rock, footprint. And then when I noticed that they were getting cold, one of the little girls had frozen snot on her upper lip and a couple of the others were starting to shiver. I marched them back into the classroom like a line of little frozen duckies and told them to stick their Post-it notes up on the board and then to rearrange them and put them in an order that sounded good to them. After that, I typed them all up and handed them out. And after I typed up their poems, printed them out, and then handed the printouts to the students and congratulated them, saying, congratulations, you're now all poets, just like Walt Whitman. And there was this unanimous squeal of six-year-olds cheering. And at that moment, that precise moment, I knew I didn't want to be a journalist anymore. But I also knew it wasn't right for me to be doing first grade. I wanted to work with the older ones, have more mature conversations, and eventually got lucky enough to work at Coral Reef Senior High School in Miami, Florida.
And you really were like right out of...
working there in the opening year of the school as a rookie teacher.
And that was your first job teaching, your first full-time job teaching?
Yes, it was.
Wow, so you were a young fella then, for sure.
Nine or ten years older than my students.
Really, so really was close in age then. There was a moment that you mentioned in the priority list, the book about a moment in college when you differed with a professor on managing a classroom. What happened there?
Well, this class was classroom management skills, basically how to discipline the students. And I just disagreed with the professor's philosophy. She was saying things like, don't smile in front of your students until Christmas. You can always be nice later if you want to, but you can't get tough later if you start off nice. And I just completely disagreed with this. And I was opinionated and rather vocal, and I was speaking to it. I recognized her as using a somewhat Machiavellian approach and said so. And I guess I insulted her with that. To which she said, what, do you think you could just make your students love you all the time? And I said something like, no, I don't think I can make them love me. But if I know my material and I come in prepared and I care about each of my students, I'm pretty sure I can make them respect me. And if they respect me, then some of them will like me, and that's enough. And at that, the professor just said, get out. I was kicked out of her class. And this was the last class that I needed before my own internship. So I was, for all intent and purposes, expelled from the College of Education. But the head of the department, Dr. Gregg, really thought I had potential as a teacher and rescued me, allowing me to take an independent study instead of that course and to get my degree and go ahead and be the teacher that I wanted to be.
I'm trying not to laugh at the irony
end
of the...
that story, though, mm-hmm. is that my book, The Priority List, is now going to be mandatory reading in classroom management skills, the class that I was kicked out of.
Is that professor still there?
The professor is not, but Dr. Gregg is, and she's the one who told me that it would be mandatory reading there. So,
well, you have to laugh.
I feel good about that.
Yeah, I can imagine. You have to laugh at the irony, though, of the professor teaching a class in classroom management skills, losing control of one student and ordering him out of the room.
Yeah. You're right.
That's big stuff. David Menashe is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is The Priority List, A Teacher's Final Quest to Discover Life's Greatest Lessons. He was ultimately forced out of the classroom after the diagnosis of a brain tumor, surgery, radiation, chemotherapy, and then a stroke finally took away a lot of the movement on the left side of his body and a lot of his vision 6 years nearly after his diagnosis. But The Priority List is his story about his effort to go ahead and reconnect with students from years past. You can join us if you'd like on the Exchange, 800-838-3760. In the Rogue Valley, it's 541-552-6782. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So speaking of classroom management, David, you point out that your very first student at Coral Reef Senior High came into the classroom drunk. What did you do?
Yes. This is the first day the school is even open. It's my first class, my first student, 7:30 in the morning. It's still dark outside. And he walks by me, and there is just the unmistakable aroma of beer all over him. And he went and sat down at the desk closest to my desk. And it really became obvious to me that he was not trying to hide this in the least. And I was determined, so I went and I sat down right next to him and had a conversation about him, asking what was going on in his life that he felt the need to be drunk at 7:30 in the morning on the first day of school. And had a conversation, and from that, he really came to respect me, that I didn't just call security or the police or the principal, but sat down and spoke with him like an adult and that I cared about him. And he turned out to be one of my best students.
Well, and here's where we point out that the book, The Priority List, includes letters from the students, including a letter from that student. How is Aaron doing these days?
Oh, he's actually doing quite well. He's living in New York, and he is a successful and satisfied businessman. It is a career that he is very good at and very happy within. And I'm proud to say that it was doing the priority list in my class that made him realize that the path he was currently on was not where he wanted to be, and that, in fact, wealth really was important to him, and that he needed to find an alternative journey.
So talk about that process of having the students prepare a priority list. Was that something that came to you after a couple of years in teaching? Was it something you had there from day one? And what was the instructions to the students?
It wasn't right away. It was after a couple of years. Initially, I was trying to come up with a way for my students to help understand and empathize with characters in literature. But later, I grew the list into a list of 26 words, 26 abstract words, words such as honor, love, wealth, respect, power, friendship, family, spirituality. And then I would give them this list of 26 words and ask them to number them in order of personal importance, putting a number one next to whatever was most important to them, and a 8, 9, so on and so forth. But this is a very difficult thing to decide who or what is more important than other things. Do you care about travel more or do you care about fun? And to have a person of any age sit down and really analyze their own priorities is a significant act of introspection. But for a 16-year-old whose life is in the midst of rapid change, they're just learning to drive, having their first romances, experiences with drugs, alcohol, all while trying to figure out what college they want to go to, what career they're interested in, where they want to live. So I wanted to create something that would help them take a bit of an emotional snapshot of who they were at that precise moment. And we would, in fact, do this twice in the year, once at the beginning and again at the end. And then I would ask them to analyze the list for the changes. And if they noticed something changed significantly, for instance, love was at number 3 at the beginning of the year, but now it's at 24. What exactly happened over the course of the year that caused that change in priorities? And then I would hear these very interesting stories of how their partner, their girlfriend, boyfriend cheated on them. And I would help them to understand that these small experiences have profound and lasting effects.
Well, all right, so I can imagine a lot of students would say, hey look, Mr. Menashe, I can come up with 5 or 10, but I can't come up with 26. I mean, how long did
you... No, the words were already there. They just had to number them in order of importance.
Oh, okay, now I understand.
All right, so I was forcing them to consider possessions versus wealth. Did they really want wealth, or did they just want to buy stuff?
Hmm. So there are some fairly nuanced terms there, then, that they'd have to be able to...
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And the first difficult task was, of course, coming to a definition of each of these words. Most adults can't define what love is. It's even more difficult for a 16-year-old to do it and then decide how important is it. And love is a separate word from sex, from family, from respect, and companionship. So they are very abstract and vague. So first, my students had to figure out what these words meant to them and then prioritize them.
You point out that the students were often talking about the amount of pressure they felt, you know, to make decisions about their lives, to know where they wanted to go after school, what they wanted to be, et cetera, et cetera. It's not like you weren't providing something similar to that, certainly through the priority list exercise, but they seemed to mind less from you in your telling of the story. Why do you suppose that was?
Because I love them and they knew it. They would ask me, Mr. Menashe, you're dying. Why are you here? Why aren't you out doing the things you love? To which I could only answer, I am. This is what I love to do. When I was in front of my class, I wasn't sick. I wasn't thinking about it. I was thinking about them. I was feeling the worst when I was at home or, you know, at the hospital. They sustained me. To paraphrase Nietzsche, he said, a person who has a why to live can always find a how. And they were my why. The how is what was up to me.
David Menashe, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is The Priority List, A Teacher's Final Quest to Discover Life's Greatest Lessons. Let's come back to what your life under some physical pressure here. That's GBM, glioblastoma multiforme.
Yes, it is the most aggressive form of cancer, which I have at its highest stage.
And so there was surgery pretty early on, it sounds like?
Yes, I've had 3 brain surgeries over the years, as well as nearly 3 years of chemotherapy, 6 weeks of radiation. I've really gone through all of the traditional cancer cures. None has worked yet, leaving me crippled and mostly blind, but I'm still alive, so I can't complain.
Well, so as you point out, you felt a lot better teaching, even on your worst days, it sounds like, than you did just sitting around at home. So it was obvious why you stayed at school. But obviously, after a while, everybody at school knew about the cancer. So how did you broach the subject or how did you discuss the subject with new students coming in each semester?
Well, I have a massive scar on the side of my head, a rainbow-shaped scar above my right ear. There's no hiding it. And no hair grows on my head on that side from the radiation. So it really was the elephant in the room. And there was just no avoiding it. I would open myself up to questions and just say to the kids, is there anything you want to ask me? I'm going to get to know you over the course of the year, but this is your opportunity to get to know me. And inevitably, one of the students would ask about the scar, to which I would answer honestly.
So between, surgery, radiation, chemo, damage to your body in other kinds of ways, and then you were also taking some meds, it sounds like, to alleviate some of the symptoms of things like chemo. And what did the meds do to you? This seems like a really critical decision you made here.
Well, I took enough pills every day to be full. And each of them came with their own side effects. You know, I had to take this one to give me energy, and then this other one to calm me down. It was strange being prescribed things like steroids and Xanax simultaneously to counteract one another.
Wow. So, yeah, you really had to keep things in balance there. At some point, did you say, forget it, I'm not going to take this or that or any of these?
Right. I was taking all of the medicines. I went through 6 years of this kind of treatment, and I still went blind and crippled. And I could understand if cancer was going to kill me, but to throw up every day and feel ill because of a decision I made was something else. I was doing this to myself. So, and I made the decision that I didn't have to live this way, that I would rather not have all these side effects from the medication, go off the meds, and live and enjoy my life. And instead of dying with cancer, try living with it for a change. And as you pointed out, I was just sitting at home without my class, bored, restless, feeling useless, and just ultimately unfulfilled. Actually, I felt like a dog waiting around for someone to come and walk him. Without the ability to drive in Miami, you're stuck. There's no public transportation available there.
Hmm. All right. So I can certainly understand what led to the making of the priority list. And we'll get into discussing what happened after that, what happened when you made your own priority list, which is also the title of the book. David Menashe, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We'll come back and talk more with David. And if you'd like to join us, we'll take your phone calls and emails as well. Back on the Jefferson Exchange to talk about the priority list with David Menashe in a minute and a half. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. David Menashe, an English teacher from a high school in Miami, is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's written a book called The Priority List, A Teacher's Final Quest to Discover Life's Greatest Lessons. David's brain tumor ultimately forced him out of the classroom 6 years after diagnosis and surgery and chemo and radiation when a stroke took away much of the movement on his left side and a lot of his vision as well. He decided to go draw up his own priority list and go visit some of his students. And that is a large part of the tale of the priority list. You can join us on the exchange if you'd like at 800-838-3760, in the Rogue Valley at 541-552-6782, or by email at jx@jeffnet.org. I haven't talked much about your family life all through this thus far, David. Your marriage did take a beating, as you point out, with Paula.
We are divorced now.
All right. Do you think that you and she talked enough about the disease?
Apparently not. We got a divorce. I mean, in retrospect. Mm-hmm. But at the time, we talked about it as much as we were both comfortable talking about it.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, certainly not an easy thing to talk about. At any point, did you allow a few chinks in the I got this front? I mean, did you have quieter moments with people where you expressed being really scared? Or was it always, were you convincing yourself as well that, you know, you're going to push this thing back as far as you can push it?
It is setting an expectation of myself that I have been trying to live up to. But I learned early on that when it comes to something like this, honesty is not the best policy. When somebody asks, how are you feeling? If I were to respond, oh, well, I'm nauseous, I just threw up 20 minutes ago, et cetera, I would only make that person feel uncomfortable and helpless, and then awkward to the point where they wouldn't want to tell me any of their problems. So it serves no advantage to me. There isn't anything that people can do about it. So I think in large part I am protecting them from the news.
Let's talk about the process then of deciding on going on your vision quest. Tell us about the steps that led up to this.
Well, I was feeling completely purposeless without my class, and I didn't know of too many places that were hiring one-armed blind guys. So I thought I could write. But I realized that all of my best stories were from the classroom over the last 15 years, and that if I wanted the rest of the story, I would have to go out and get it. And since my kids weren't coming back to me, I was going to have to go to them. So I put a post on Facebook saying I would like to do some traveling and asked who had a couch for me. And within 48 hours, I had offers from over 50 cities. So I set out on the road by myself, alone in the winter, having recently quit treatment, to go visit my kids, many of which I haven't seen for 15 years, to find out if I made a difference, and if so, exactly what it was.
I can imagine more than a few people tried to talk you out of this vision quest.
Absolutely. Most medical professionals right off the top said that this was not going to extend my life and would likely cut it down dramatically. But for me, it was a decision of quantity versus quality. And I needed a reason to want to continue going through chemotherapy, something to make it all worthwhile. And there's no question that I went out on the road to meet my fate squarely, whatever it may be. If I should die, then there it is. This is something I had been told for years was going to happen and had become quite comfortable with.
Well, for that matter, I mean, was there a point at which you thought, so what's going on? I'm still here. It's been 2 years. It's been 4 years. You know, I'm finally had to quit teaching after nearly 6 years of, after the diagnosis. But, I mean, at some point, did you start thinking, well, gee, I seem to be living on borrowed time here?
Oh, I know I am. I know I'm living well past my expiration date.
A sell-by date, in essence.
Absolutely. Huh. Better smell this milk before drinking it.
All right. So talk about when you first put the item on Facebook to ask about places to stay. And were you concerned you'd get very few responses?
Well, over the years, I've taught nearly 3,000 students. So I was certain that I would find a few cities, but not as many as I did. I didn't even expect that my students would be as spread out as they were, with responses coming from as far as possible in the continental United States. I was in Miami at the time, and I'm getting responses from places like Alaska, Hawaii, California, Washington, Oregon, and more, it just became this fantasy road trip where I would take trains and buses and occasionally catch car rides or hitchhike from one person to the next, from one person I love to another, and people who love me as well.
And so so what was your first destination? So, let's see, we actually talked about coming to Tallahassee, and you found more than students there. Tell us about finding Jenny in Tallahassee.
Oh, Jenny. Okay. Jenny Armas is a girl from my youth. When we were both 14 years old, we had a special night at a friend's birthday party. This birthday party was a sweet 16 on a boat, and she and I ended up kissing this night, and it was each of our first kiss. And we tried to maintain a relationship, but she lived too far away, and neither of us knew how to drive. And this is the era before cell phones, where if I needed to call her, I was calling the kitchen and had to speak to her father first. So it was doomed to fail, and did, and I never saw her again. And then, November of 2012, while in Tallahassee, she shows up to the kickoff party. Jenny Armas. Jenny effing Armas. I couldn't believe she was there. It was great. And it was really special to know that I meant enough to her that not only was she keeping up with me on Facebook, but that she made it a point to come out and see me on this first night of the trip and wish me well.
So how many students were had showed up at that very same gathering?
At that first gathering, I think it was probably in the neighborhood of 45 to 55, somewhere in there.
Wow. That's a good collection just for one city. Granted, it is in Florida still, but
right, and it is where the Florida State University is, where a lot of my students were going.
How hard was it, David, to make the plans, just to make the plans, taking into account the weakness of your left side and your near blindness?
Well, I'm not completely blind. I can see a spot in front of me. It's a lot like looking at the world through a paper towel tube. But I can see on my phone. I can use Facebook and email and make phone calls. And really, I did the entire thing, including the writing of the book, using my phone and voice recognition.
Wow, it's a good thing you speak clearly.
Well, I learned to, and to enunciate. Voice recognition frequently screws up what I am saying and just turns it into some kind of gibberish. So there was definitely a lot of revision needed.
No doubt. So you talked about obviously you couldn't drive, so it was going to get around with public transportation. But seriously, hitchhiking in your condition, was this a good idea?
No, not at all. But I didn't have a choice. My student, who I was visiting in New Orleans, was supposed to be giving me a ride, to New Orleans. Excuse me, Atlanta from New Orleans, which was my next stop. And we're driving, going east, going the right way, and we end up in the middle of nowhere in the bayou somewhere where GPS goes out. We don't have a phone signal. There's no street lamps. We can't even see the signs. And we end up getting turned around and going the wrong way and end up driving north through Mississippi and Tennessee until finally she says, look, I've got to work in the morning. I can't drive around all night. And she drops me off at a motel somewhere outside of Mobile, Alabama, just a roadside motel. And I went and I spoke to the woman working at the desk, asked where the nearest train station was, and it was impossibly far, and it was also where the bus station was. And then I asked if there was a way I can get a cab to come out here, and she said, good luck, we're 50 miles outside of Mobile. There was no choice. So come morning, when I realized I was still out there, still with no phone signal, I didn't really have a choice but to just stick out my thumb, red tip cane and all, and hope for a ride.
So there must have been, I gather there were some surprising moments where, I mean, people who you had not planned on encountering, not former students, not people you knew at all, just strangers were giving you some support.
That's true. For instance, in Chicago, a Facebook friend sent me a message that she's in Chicago and has a couch for me. And I didn't have that many offers in Chicago. So I looked her up on Facebook, and she seemed like a very nice person. She was working in the school system there. So I took her up on her offer. But when I met her in Chicago, I realized I did not recognize her in the least. And I couldn't remember her name either. So I begin trying to get it to come out organically in conversation. At this point, we had been together too long for me just to ask her, how do I know you?
Uh-huh.
So I tried to fish it out of her by asking what was her favorite book she read in my class, because based on the book, I would know what year she was there because I changed the novels every year.
Uh-huh.
Then she said, oh, I was never in your class. I went to Coral Reef and I knew you, but I only found out about this trip through a mutual friend, and I thought I could help out. So I thanked her for it and then realized I'd be spending the next couple days with a complete stranger, albeit a kind-hearted, well-intentioned one.
Uh-huh. But, I mean, it sounds like it was hard at times to accept the nice things that people wanted to do for you.
Well, there's no question that it was difficult on many levels. First of all, these are people that I didn't really know. Even if I knew them in the classroom, that was 15 years ago. They've gone on to become completely different people now. So this is a new city, for all intent and purposes, a new person, and I'm dealing with it all in what is still to me a new body, one that doesn't have a left hand that works or have good vision. So there's no question that it was a grand adventure.
David, were some of your former students and other acquaintances from through the years rattled a bit by the sight of you when you did get back together with them?
Maybe initially, but then when I was in the midst of showing them that despite I look the way I look, I still made it all the way out to San Francisco. I still did this. And right away, that would evaporate the sympathy, which is what I really wanted, you know, to show them something worth looking at, not something worth pitying. That, and really, it's what I'm hoping all my readers get from this book, that no matter what your disability, whatever your difficulty, your trauma, your heartache, that there is still a way to live a life of purpose, fulfillment, and happiness. And that if I can do it, if I can travel the country blind and crippled by myself, then anybody can and probably should.
So one of the physical goals was actually to swim in the Pacific Ocean. You mentioned getting to San Francisco. Did you actually do the swim part too?
I got my feet in there, but that thing is freezing.
I was about to say, I hope you swam in L.A., but in San Francisco, it's cold. Yeah,
it was late January in San Francisco. It was so cold, I was surprised that it was even liquid.
It is mighty chilly water. So don't forget that we're further north than even that. So there are lots of positive stories, obviously, from reconnecting with these people who felt like they got a lot from you as a teacher in your English classes in Miami. Is there one story that stands out above all others, one reconnection that just made you go, whoa?
No, I couldn't say that there's one, but since we were just talking about San Francisco, I've got to say, meeting up with Mona in San Francisco was especially wonderful because she is now a mother, she is married, and she's a published author. She has a book of her own and credits me for a lot of these things, for introducing her to writing, helping her with her English. She was an Iranian immigrant. So I helped her with a lot of these kinds of things and turning her on to feminism, which is what she has made her career and the subject of her writing to be. So I did find out that I had this profound effect on her at the same time that I'm at the Pacific Ocean. I finally did it. And for all those people that said, you know, that I shouldn't go on this trip, I just felt like shouting, how do you like me now? Here I am.
I see that you are doing some limited events with the publicity for the book, that you're going to do a book signing next week in Coral Gables.
Yeah, then, my home turf.
Mm-hmm. But I can't imagine you doing much other traveling for the book, and we very much appreciate you being available to us by phone today. But this must be an odyssey of itself, though. I mean, not a vision quest necessarily, anything like the book itself, but getting out to meet people and talk about the book.
You're absolutely right. It is. And it's been my honor to be able to meet people in person and over the radio. It's really been something special, because in the end, it really is people that is the most valuable thing that I have.
How hard, what is it, if at all, to convince some of your former students to write letters that are included in the book?
Oh, no, those came to me on their own volition.
Really? So it wasn't
Were a few students that I did specifically reach out to because I knew they had these stories. And I would ask them, would you mind writing me a letter, you know, et cetera. But for the most part, those were just sent to me when they knew I was doing interviews and trying to get help. Those were sent to me by the kids I couldn't get to.
It is a very moving book, The Priority List, A Teacher's Final Quest to Discover Life's Greatest Lessons. David Menashe, thanks so much for joining us, and best of luck to you.
Thank you very much. Have a wonderful afternoon.
You too. Take care. That's it for today's Jefferson Exchange. You can find out more about the program and subjects and suggest a guest at jeffexchange.org. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. Tomorrow on The Exchange at 8 o'clock, we'll talk about a preview for the upcoming Martin Luther King Day observances in Ashland. We'll talk to a Southern Oregon University professor who just won an Oregon Literary Fellowship. And then we'll talk to a University of Oregon professor in the 9 o'clock hour about dark matter and the hidden universe. That's Dr. James Brow, all tomorrow on the Jefferson Exchange. Our producer is Charlotte Duren. Our student assistant at the controls, Reed Newland. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Talk to you again soon on another edition of the Jefferson Exchange here on JPR. Have a great day.